This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. A year ago, Irish Prime Minister Enda Kenny apologized to the women who were the survivors of the Magdalen laundries. Women and girls held in these notorious institutions had no rights, were forced to work without pay, were often mistreated, and if they were pregnant, forced to give up their children.
As a society, for many years, we failed you. We forgot you, or if we thought of you at all, we did so in untrue and offensive stereotypes. This is a national shame, for which I say again, I'm deeply sorry and offer my full and heartfelt apologies. At the conclusion of my discussions with one group of the Magdalen women, one of those present sang Whispering Hope. A line from that song stays in my mind. When the dark midnight is over, watch for the breaking of day. Let me hope that this day and this debate, heralds a new dawn for all those who feared that the dark midnight might never end.
Our guest, Mary Steed, was one of those Magdalen children. She was adopted by an American family in the 1960s and grew up in the Philadelphia region. After a long search, she reunited with her birth mother in 2002, who worked for 10 years at a laundry in Cork. Steed co-founded Justice for the Magdalens and is a staunch advocate for these mothers and their children, now, of course, adults. The new film, Philomena, has shed light on this shocking story. Mary Steed joins us here in our Philadelphia studios, and it's a great pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me, Marty.
You're welcome. That was a speech that the Prime Minister gave a year ago. He talked about a new dawn. A year later, are things better? And by that, I mean, the Magdalen women, have they gotten some kind of justice for what happened to them?
Well, we're still waiting for the dawn to break. As of today, we have had no checks going out to these women. They have gotten letters through the Magdalen Commission that's in charge of the redress process. But it's still been a delaying game, you know, just actually getting the payments to them.
And we're talking about compensation.
Correct,
compensation
right.
For the years that they were in these laundries.
Right. This would be lost wages and pensions that they were entitled to while they worked.
And how many women are we talking about today?
The applications received thus far, I think, are about 800 by the commission. There's probably still, we reckon, anywhere from 500 to another 1,000 women still living, maybe in the U.S., in the U.K.
Help us understand, I guess, the history of the—I mean, they're called laundries, but help us understand the history of these Magdalen laundries in Ireland.
Well, they actually began back in the 18th century, and they were part of what were popularly known as Protestant rescue crusades. And the objective at that time was to take prostitutes in off the streets, teach them a trade, give them some sort of a working background other than what they had been doing, and then release them back into society after a couple of years. They were picked up on in the latter part of the 19th century by Catholic religious organizations, and of course the population of prostitutes, dwindling, they looked for other sources, and so the net sort of was cast a bit wider, and you had girls who maybe were just from poor backgrounds, broken homes, found destitute on the street, begging. Or for just being potentially of moral risk, which meant they could
moral
be too
risk.
Pretty, a little bit cheeky or flirty, and they were just basically scooped up and sent to these places.
Did they have any rights once they were inside these places?
No. You were locked inside. You were certainly never allowed out. We've got plenty of evidence of girls who tried to escape and then were promptly dragged back by the police. So there was, collusion by government agents to make sure that these girls were kept incarcerated.
And did they do was laundry the sort of number one work?
That would have been the biggest commercial enterprise, but they also ran quite large sewing operations. And actually, that was what my mother did. She was a very tiny woman, so she would have been very unsuitable to the harsh tasks of doing the laundry. But she was very skilled at embroidery and sewing. So they had her doing a lot of the clerical garments, sewing for commercial purposes, that sort of thing.
And what were conditions like where she was?
Well, I mean, it was a very harsh regime. You were up at the crack of dawn. Of course, you always had to go to Mass first thing in the morning or do prayers. And in many cases, that involved kneeling for hours at a time. They'd be on a cold floor. especially if they were being punished, that might even involve being laid out prone for hours at a time to do some sort of a penance. Of course, the work would be as soon as they got out of Mass, so, you know, maybe had a bit of breakfast, not much, off to work, maybe they had their tea at 4 o'clock, and then that was it. And then they would be locked in their rooms at night.
And what would you be punished for at one of these laundries?
Well, speaking out to a nun, refusing to do a task, you know, maybe if you claimed you were sick or not up to it. Of course, right. You know, that might not be believed, and you'd be punished for that. Punishments also included cutting their hair. That was, you know, seen as a symbolic, well, we'll take one of your most prideful things away from you, which could be your pretty hair. Beatings were quite frequent and well documented by different testimonies that we've received. So, you know, quite severe.
And were they also, what, shamed? And let's say they were pregnant. Your mother got pregnant. Mm-hmm. Were they shamed for being sexually either active or having gotten pregnant?
Well, they were shamed from the moment they walked in there. I mean, for starts, they had their names taken away from them. So you first and foremost, you lose your identity. And then you're basically told that you're in there, you know, by the grace of the nuns, and because you have nowhere else to go, or your parents aren't good enough to raise you, whatever the background might be. Certainly if they were pregnant, now they wouldn't have actually stayed in the laundries if they were pregnant. And my mother actually became pregnant after she left the laundry, so it was not a situation where she gave birth to me there. But if it was discovered when they were admitted that they were pregnant, then they would have been sent to a neighboring mother and baby home, had the child, and then if they had no family or other circumstances to go back to, they get sent right back to the laundry and the child would be adopted out.
In fact, your mother was sent to it was called the Bessborough Mother and Baby Home. It was in Cork.
Correct, yes. Yeah.
And how many years? I said 10 years doing some research.
She was 10 years at Sunday's Well, which was the Magdalen Laundry in Cork. She was released at the age of about 26, and apparently she had done a good enough job with the nuns and kind of kept herself out of trouble that they actually gave her a work referral to work for another order at a hospital in Dublin. Now, you know, again, I know people find this hard to believe. Your mother was 26 years old when she had you. But I always have to view it through the lens that she came through the industrial school system. So from the age of a small child, she lost her own mother. She was taken away from her mother for the crime of being born outside of marriage. Because there was no legal adoption in Ireland, the only recourse at that point would have been to be boarded out or fostered to a family, or to go into industrial school. So 14 years there, 10 years in the Magdalen Laundry. By the time she came out at 26, she had no clue what a man was,
right.
You know, much less anything to do with her body. Right. So these women were naive in the extreme, so it's no surprise that, and starved for affection too. I mean, let's be blunt. So she met my father, became pregnant, and then was promptly sent down back to Cork to the mother and baby home there.
Is this slavery that we're talking about when we talk about the conditions these women lived under?
I mean, absolutely. The UN completely agreed with us on that score, as well as the torture. I mean, acts such as cutting hair, those are considered acts of torture under the terms of the United Nations. Slavery, yes, they weren't paid for any of the enterprises that they were involved in, sewing or laundry, yet the nuns were making profits from that. They were doing commercial services. No pensions were paid into by the religious orders, so when they retired or, you know, there was no way to claim any kind of a pension for that work.
Were they viewed as criminals?
Somehow
broken the law by their actions?
Yes, in some cases they were. There were women who were remanded to laundries through the court system, and certainly, you know, some of them did commit crimes. Some of them were fairly petty, you know, maybe a minor theft or stealing some food if they were starving. Sadly, some of it was for infanticide. You know, some of these women would try to hide pregnancies and ended up murdering their infants, and that's very tragic. But then again, that's also, you know, feeding off the culture and the mores of society at that time.
The Irish government did, as we heard, did apologize and acknowledge, I guess, the role that the government played in these Magdalen laundries. How about the order of nuns that were associated with some of these laundries?
We've yet to receive any kind of true meaningful apologies. They came out shortly before Tisha Kenny's speech and issued, I hate to use the term apology, because one of them almost sounded like a maitre d' saying, I'm very sorry you didn't find the meal to your liking. But really compassionate, thorough apologies have not come from the four orders.
And what would that sound like to you? What language are you looking for?
The language would be acknowledgement of what they did wrong, that they treated these women as less than, as subhuman, as something not at the same level as they were. And let's face it, we're all women. I mean, I would think women would have more respect for other women, but it certainly wasn't the case with the laundries. To apologize for their role in incarcerating them, not granting them their freedom, treating them, not feeding them properly, you know, misusing their labor. There are so many things that they need to go into, and especially with those women who died, to apologize and say, we're sorry we didn't even give you a decent burial, that you're lying in a mass grave unmarked.
In fact, there was a mass grave discovered, more than 100 bodies or 150 bodies? Something?
Correct. Yeah, in Dublin at the Hyde Park Convent, they found 155 bodies, although they only had plans to exhume or permission to exhume 122, and death certificates for only 133 of them, so we don't even know how some of them died. In one case, there was a grave they dug up that contained one skeleton but two skulls. So we have no idea how that occurred. But these exist at all the laundries. It's not just Hyde Park. We know that there are mass graves at every one of them.
About a minute before our break here, and I wonder just how much the movie Philomena has revived interest in what happened to these women and the history of these laundries in Ireland.
Well, it has revived it, and it has brought a lot more women forward. Unfortunately, there does seem to be confusion because now we have women who were victims of forced and often illegal adoptions who now believe that they can be compensated under the Magdalen terms, and that's obviously not the case. We still need to fight their corner. But it has at least brought them out of the woodwork, which is excellent.
And have you met Philomena Lee?
I have, yeah. I spent last week traveling to Washington, D.C. with she and her daughter Jane. We met with some key representatives on the Hill to talk about what the those of us that were sent to the United States, what we face, trying to go back and trace our roots or find our original identities. And it was very positive. We had a great trip. I've actually known the two of them for years when they first started searching for her son. So it was nice to be able to reconnect.
Well, I want to pick up on a very short break and take a very short break and pick up on your story, Mary Steed. And we are talking with Mary Steed, the daughter of a Magdalen survivor. If you have seen the movie Philomena, you probably know a bit of what we're talking about. Mary Steed co-founded Justice for Magdalens. This was back in 2003. She did reconnect with her mother who died over Christmas just recently. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Phone number 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Support for WHYY comes from Widener University. Widener University offers over 60 graduate degree programs, including physical therapy, which combines classwork with hands-on learning in one of the nation's first student-led pro bono physical therapy clinics. Widener University is hosting a graduate open house on March 11th from 5 to 7 p.m. That's March 11th from 5 to 7 p.m. Registration is available now at widener.edu/leadership. That's widener.edu/leadership. Widener Leadership Works.
I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're in the middle of the membership drive here at WHYY. Yes, it's snowing outside, but that doesn't mean you can't take just a few minutes and become a member of WHYY. Make a pledge of support right now to ensure that WHYY and Radio Times remain strong and continue to serve you with the news and information that keep you in the know. What's that worth to you? $5, $10, $20 a month? Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. You can also pledge online online at whyy.org. Today we're talking about an important issue, immigration, and what states are doing about it. And our guest is Mary Steed, whose mother worked at a notorious Magdalene laundry in Ireland and was forced to give her up for adoption. Mary was instrumental in getting the Irish government to apologize. That's what we do every day on Radio Times, keep you up to speed on events and introduce you to interesting people and ideas. 1-888-345-9499, whyy.org. Thanks. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Mary Steed and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You've been able to piece together, I guess, your story and also the story of your mother. You spent, what, about 10 years tracking her down?
I did. Yeah, I started back in the early days of the Internet. I was working at a technological university, so we had very early access to it. And I remember the very first keyword I ever typed in a search engine was adoption. You know, I was obviously seeking out my mother, but I was also seeking a daughter that I had lost to adoption. So those were twin paths that I had set out on at the time. But, yeah, it was a very difficult long haul with my mother.
In fact, yeah, you had gotten pregnant in high school. I guess you were a senior in high school and went to St. Vincent's.
Yes, I did.
Which is here in the Philadelphia area and had a little girl.
I did, yes.
And what, gave her up for adoption yourself?
Yeah, I mean, again, you know, even though we're talking 1978, the choices were not really out there, especially if you were a good, you know, Catholic schoolgirl at the time. It was more or less, this is what you're going to do, not these are your options. And I really didn't have a whole lot of say in the matter, despite being 18. Mm. But, I was very grateful that at least I have been able to reconnect with her and her wonderful adoptive family and, you know, her birth father's side of the family. So they're all very joyfully reunited.
When did you know as a little girl growing up that you had been adopted?
My brother and I were told very early on, I mean, primarily because we came over as toddlers. We were walking, talking, came off a plane in New York. So, you know, obviously it's not the sort of thing you can make up a story, a little background about. But my parents were great. They were very open about it. My mother even went back to Ireland in 1983 to try to get more information for us and unfortunately came away with nothing. So the layers of secrecy even apply to adoptive parents. Even they are not entitled to information, much of it, on our backgrounds.
But as you said, 20 years ago, you type in the word adoption with the thought of what, tracking down your mother, trying to find your mother, your biological mother?
Yeah, and of course, I started with, you know, some of the early U.S. Adoption support groups. And of course, none of them knew anything about Ireland or what resources were out there for me. So it took a while of chipping and plotting. And then I finally stumbled across a group of folks based in Dublin who had been doing sort of what we were doing in the U.S., working for reform and support, trying to open records. And I connected with them. And from there, I was put in touch with a woman in London who was just very handy at doing records research.
Wow.
So she was able to find not only, you know, information on my mother's background in Ireland, but the fact that she had come to the UK and married there. So she found a marriage certificate for her. And that was sort of our first solid clue toward finding her.
Did you know your mother had lived in the Magdalene laundries? And did you know what those laundries were back then?
I did. Maybe not quite one and two. It was more two and one. I had gotten, I guess at some point in my request writing to Ireland, information from the Good Shepherd sisters that she had spent 10 years with them. But they never really described what they were or what type of place they ran. I had no clue why she was there. I didn't really understand what these places were. And then it wasn't until the late 1990s with the discovery of the graves in Hyde Park in Dublin that I went, oh, the penny dropped, and I realized
really?
That that's where she was, that this was just another Magdalene laundry but based in Cork. From there, I knew her background, probably knew maybe even more than she knew herself by the time I found her, and was obviously quite startled at what I learned.
Well, I was reading about, I guess, your discovery of that first conversation with your mother. You're on the telephone, and, I'm trying to imagine what do you say to somebody under those circumstances?
What do you
talk about?
A thousand things in your mind, how it's going to go. And all I remember is my friend Judy in London, the woman who had led me to her, called me at 6 a.m. in the morning at my home and said, I'm just off the phone with your mother. She can't wait to hear from you. Here's her phone number. So, you know, with my hand shaking, I'm dialing the phone number thinking, what do I say? What do I say? But there really was nothing to say because it was the most natural conversation in the world. Just, oh, I'm so glad to hear your voice. And almost as though we had just spoken the week before. It just picked up from there and was just very warm, natural, not forced at all.
Had she been looking for you?
She had. She did try to attempt to go back over at one point to Ireland and asked, I guess, the nuns at Bessborough, you know, was there any information on me, which actually there was because my adoptive parents had sent back letters and photos and so forth. But they turned her away and just, you know, said, go on with your life. Don't worry about that. You know, you're not, you signed documentation that you would never seek to trace her. And sent her packing. But so at that stage, I think she just sort of sat back and said, well, my Mary will find me. And I did.
So. And she married?
She did, yeah. Her first husband died in 1987, and then she remarried, but never had any other children. So that, you know, I was it for her.
And when you met her, did you look alike? I mean, were there certain mannerisms that you had that were similar?
We look like identical twins. Yeah,
do
we
really?
Do. And actually, it's funny because I did one of those sort of spur of the moment, once I had her phone number, and this was actually early on. Well, not early on, but not long before I first really reached out to her. And I thought, I'll take a chance and just call, but I did one of those classic hang up the phone things. As soon as I heard her voice, I thought she really sounds just same timbre, you know, same voice, just with a sort of Irish mixed UK accent. And I was pretty certain then. I thought, you know, yeah, this has got to be the right woman. That's just too eerie, you know, to almost hear your voice being echoed back to you. Yeah, we look very much alike.
And you were able to spend, that, what, about 10 years when she was alive, I guess the last 10 years of her life.
Yeah, we did. You know, got over as regularly as I could to visit with her. And she and her husband came over to us in 2003. So we had very precious but good years together and lots of phone calls in between. And
was she bitter about what had happened to her?
Not
as
at
a younger
all.
Woman?
Again, I sort of call it the Philomena.
Effect,
yeah. I don't know what it is. These women, and we found it with the Magdalene women too. There's just such a sense of dignity and compassion and graciousness about them. Just to illustrate it, the night of the apology, when the Prime Minister apologized, we had, I'd say, maybe about a dozen women who were sitting up in the gallery in the Irish Doyle. And at the conclusion of his speech, when he did become a little choked up, they were worried about him. They were so concerned about him, but not a thing about their own predicament or themselves. And that's how they are in general. They just I don't know if it takes a certain mentality to rise above that and realize it's not doing me any good to be angry and bitter. I have to forgive. I have to be compassionate. Honestly, they could teach a few lessons to some of the nuns that incarcerated them.
Have you forgiven?
I have. I think, you know, again, my mother was a big factor in that because she didn't really hold any bitterness and had held on to her faith. You know, I'm not a practicing Catholic anymore, but I know that there were good nuns. I know there were some that did try to make their lives a little more decent. They were few and far between, and I wish they had spoken up more at the time. But, you know, that said, there are always good people behind some of these villains. And you know, if you spent your whole life doing that, you'd just be sick and horrible and angry, and it just doesn't do anyone any good.
Let me reintroduce you. That's Mary Steed, our guest in this hour of Radio Time. She co-founded Justice for Magdalens in 2003. We're talking about the Magdalene laundries in Ireland, the fact that her mother spent some time living and working in these laundries, or in a laundry in Cork. And she was instrumental in putting pressure on the Irish government to apologize for the treatment of these women and girls. So we played a clip of the Prime Minister speaking last year. We're also taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Any questions or comments for our guests? Was it difficult to talk to your mother about, you know, you're, what, 18 months with her as a little baby?
Interestingly, no. With the mother and baby home, she was actually very open about that and would discuss it. She's done interviews, you know, with the Irish press on it, and was really quite willing to talk about that part of her life. But the Magdalene experience was definitely something that she kept very quiet, even for me. She would sometimes sort of acknowledge it or acknowledge that I knew about it, but didn't really want to talk about it. So there was definitely, I think, more stigma even attached to that than having a child out of wedlock, at least in her mind.
And you think it was just painful memories for her?
I think so. Very shameful. And it's unfortunate in the UK. I know that there is sort of even more stigma attached to it. And a lot of the expats that come over from Ireland often get bullied, even by their own, if they admit that they came out of an industrial school background or out of a Magdalen laundry. So they keep that very quiet. They just don't talk about their backgrounds at all, or they'll make up some sort of a backstory for themselves.
You were adopted about the age of 18 months?
Yeah, I was almost two. 20 months when I came over. So there again, I was walking, talking. I had a sense of identity and self, and obviously had regular contact with my mother.
Right.
They all took care of us during the day and breastfed us and so forth. So I look back on some of those early photos and film that my adoptive father took when I arrived, and it's just this, utterly traumatized child.
You can see that on your face?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Sad?
Yeah, sad, confused, don't know where I am, obviously missing or, having lost someone or something. I've often heard from some of my friends here who might have even been a little older that they had to go through speech therapy classes, to get rid of their Irish accents, which is sort of sad. So we lost a lot, coming over here.
In the film, Philomena, I'm not sure how close it is to her true life, but we see her child being taken from her, and she's, looking through the window, and she sees this what looks like a very wealthy couple driving off with her child. Do you know the circumstances of
I do. That part is absolutely true in the movie, and I know Philomena herself would say this. The comedic bits are sort of there as dramatic license, but all of the really sad bits are absolutely spot on true. And I think what's interesting, too, when we were dealing with the Magdalen campaign, so often the women's testimony would be questioned or sort of aspersions cast upon it. But it never wavered. No matter what home or what Magdalen laundry the woman was in, their related experiences were nearly identical. Mm. And the same with the mother-baby homes. My mother has recounted the exact same leaving scenario where the black car came up and I was put in, and she's never met Philomena. So it's interesting to see that these women all had that same experience and often would be encouraged to run up to the top of the house so they could look out the window if they knew their baby was going. Another girl might, or one of the friendlier nuns would say, quick, quick, go up and, look out the window so you can see them. And their hearts would break.
I'm sure. I mean, I'm assuming she thought at some point you would be adopted. I mean, have a fantasy that somehow you would be adopted?
Yeah, I mean, they were under no illusions that there were no choices for them. There was no lone parent support in Ireland at the time. So, the option was, do I give my child a better chance? And I think they did tell her I was going to the United States. So in some sense, she was thrilled at that. In other words, my child at least is going to have this marvelous home, which I did, and have far better opportunities than I can give her at this point. Now, in hindsight, she bettered her own circumstances fairly quickly after that. And could we have made it together? Absolutely. But that didn't exist at the time.
The last Magdalen laundry to close in Ireland was 1996.
That's correct.
When I read that, I thought, no, that has to be incorrect.
No, Sean McDermott Street was the last laundry to close its doors. Now, bearing in mind, I don't believe after the late 1970s they were doing much in the way of commercial laundry, but there were still former Magdalens living there and doing whatever they were able to do, given that they were advanced aged at the time. So, whether it be sewing or doing up the little holy cards with yarn, they had them, kept them busy.
You started this, or you co-founded Justice for Magdalens in 2003. Was there a kind of precipitating moment? Was it finding your mother and learning her story?
Well, it was a combination of things. Yeah, that certainly spurred me on to want to do more, to learn more about these institutions. And at the same time, Ireland was dealing with its first piece of dirty carpet, which was the abuse scandals. The industrial school survivors had taken their case forward, and it was being investigated at the time. And we actually were under the impression at the beginning of that investigation that they were also going to look into both the mother and baby homes and the Magdalene laundries. And unfortunately, that wasn't the case. So by 2002, when it became clear that they were not going to be included under that redress scheme, we knew we had to do something. Mm. So that was sort of what the defining moment of when we decided to start Justice for Magdalene's.
And I know eventually you testified, or members of your organization testified before the United Nations.
Yes, we took a case in 2011. Ireland was under review by the UN Committee Against Torture, and we made a submission backed by several other human rights groups. Amnesty International in Ireland came to our defense. Their ICCL, which would be equivalent to our ACLU, and their Human Rights Commission. So, we all filed sort of joint submissions on behalf of the Magdalenes, and the UN said, yep, you are guilty of all these crimes. So.
And did you testify? You
I did not personally. My mother and my story was included in the testimonies, but I did not go to Geneva. So.
But do you think that was pressure put on the Irish government to at least acknowledge?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, that was sort of the tipping point for us, because up until that point, we've been dragging it through different ministers and legislators in Ireland. And although they make great noises, nothing was really being done. So I think it finally took taking them to an international stage and embarrassing them and saying, look, you know, you have to be held accountable for these are human rights violations.
And even in your own personal story to find your mother, I mean, did people lie to you, or was it just documents you couldn't find or information that people didn't want to share with you?
Yeah, it was a combination of both. I mean, the records are very much sealed in Ireland. I think for obvious reasons, there's so much bad practice that they would rather it stay hidden. Of course, some of it was also lying or not offering the information or chasing after the wrong information. That was something that we found fairly common with some of the agencies in Ireland, is they would lead you down a merry garden path thinking, oh, we found your mother, and it was the wrong person. And even years after I found my mother, I was still getting letters from the convent in Cork saying, well, we think you found the wrong woman. Now, I mean, there are half-blind people who have seen photos of my mother and I and thought, that's ridiculous, you know. And not only that, but she had photos in her possession from not only when I was at Bessborough and other children, actual photos taken there. She had a photo that was sent to her right after she left Ireland by the agency that my adopted mother had sent of my first Christmas in the U.S., so I thought, if it's the wrong woman, then why in the world would she have a photo of me and my adoptive cousins at Christmas? That just beggars belief.
And she was living in the U.K., I guess, at
yes,
that
she
time.
Was. Right.
And obviously, and kept that photo of you.
Yes, she did. Yeah. And they knew obviously, if they got a photo to her, they knew her address. And she had not moved address from 1966 forward. So there again to say, well, we don't know where she went, or, you know, it was, again, like Philomena's quest, just boxing people at both sides and saying, no, you know, we're just not going to put them in touch.
Let's take another short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Our guest is Mary Steed, the daughter of a Magdalene survivor. She co-founded Justice for Magdalene's back in 2003, lives here in the Philadelphia region. And we're talking about her story, also talking about efforts to compensate and find justice for women and girls who were essentially locked away in laundries during the 20th century, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times, or send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY Art and Theater Company presents the Pulitzer Prize-winning play Water by the Spoonful, on stage now through March 16th. A group of strangers seeks connection, recovery, and redemption in this new play that redefines what it means to be a family. From the Main Line to Girard Avenue, Swarthmore College to an online chat room, playwright Kiara Alegria-Hudez draws from her Philadelphia roots. Art and Theater Company presents Water by the Spoonful. Tickets at 215-922-1122 or artandtheater.org.
I'm Marty Moscoen. It's the winter membership campaign here at WHYY, and it's snowing outside. A perfect time and a perfect reason to be a member of your station for news and information. Think of what you hear every day, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You've got the BBC, Morning Edition, Radio Times, The Takeaway, Here and Now, Fresh Air, All Things Considered, Newsworks Tonight, and that's just a partial list. And how about our newest program, The Pulse? We've done our job to bring you a diverse lineup of shows, something for everybody. Now it's time for you to do your part and become a member of WHYY to support the shows that you rely on and enjoy. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499, 1-888-345-WHYY, and you can pledge online at WHYY.org. We do this just a few times a year, a reminder that we could not do our jobs without your pledge of support. So make that call, make that pledge. Thanks very much. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen. The movie Philomena, starring Judi Dench, is based on the true story of Philomena Lee and her search for her son, who was adopted against her will while she lived at a Catholic-run home for unwed mothers in Ireland. She is now lobbying to reunite other Irish mothers and their adopted children. Our guest, Mary Steed, is one of those children. Her mother lived and worked at one of the notorious Magdalen laundries in Cork, Ireland. She co-founded Justice for Magdalens, has been instrumental in exposing the mistreatment of these women, and I should add the last laundry closed in the 1990s. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I wonder about this effort to reunite these mothers and their children. You reunited with your mother. You reunited with your daughter. Those can be very complicated, those can be very, very complicated, yes. I would think. Not as just simple as getting people in a room together,
right,
and then all is sort of forgiven or forgotten.
Right, right. And there are no guarantees that there's always going to be a happy ending. I've always advocated for many, many years, and in fact sort of took this attitude with my own search, you know, prepare yourself for the worst, because either you may meet with rejection. This is a woman who could have been so traumatized and stigmatized by what she suffered that she simply can't come to terms with it. We understand that. Or she just may not be in a place in her life. She hasn't told her husband or her other children. Perfectly understandable outcomes. Or you may have found that your mother died. You know, we're dealing with an aging population. We ourselves are not getting any younger, so that's always a possibility. So I just urge people to, you know, go in with both eyes open, be very cautious, obviously, you know, deal with well-trained people who know how to advise you how to make that first approach, how to write a letter, how to reach out in ways that are not intrusive or disruptive. We certainly don't advocate people going banging on doors, you know, showing up at Thanksgiving dinner, you know, here I am. That's not the way to do it. But at the end of the day, too, I think the other thing that we have to recognize is human relationships are complex, even with your own blood relations.
Absolutely.
Or the families that you've been raised by or grew up with. And I think to stigmatize adopted people further by saying, well, you know, you may really wreck someone's life, I think that's unfair and it's discriminatory. We have laws in place that protect people from unwarranted harassment, stalking, things like that. To add extra layers of protection is giving natural parents or adopted people mm-hmm. a right of protection that no other citizen enjoys. That's discriminatory.
I don't know whether you found your daughter or your daughter found you or you were both looking for each other. I wonder how much that has sort of helped you to think through this whole process.
Right. Yeah. No, we were both approaching it at sort of slightly different times. She reached out when she was about 15, which is typical. Young girls get curious as they hit, you know, adolescence, started asking questions, and her adoptive parents were quite happy to help her out, showed her a letter that they had been given that I wrote back when she was adopted, and helped her through that process. And then I started maybe about 3 years after that, because mm-hmm. I figured I'd wait till she was 18. I'm not going to disturb a minor child. And so we sort of found each other around the same time, and it worked out.
Was that something that had haunted you, the fact that you had given up a child?
Oh, absolutely. It never leaves you. Anyone who says that they're not affected by it or they'd have to be a really, really cold human being. I mean, you can't have a child and then forget that child despite what we were told, which was to forget and move on. It's impossible.
I was reading about you, I think it was in Philadelphia Magazine, about what sounded like a really bad marriage that you got yourself into with a man who was had some pretty serious problems.
Right.
In fact, committed suicide in front of you.
Yes, he did. Yeah.
I mean, do you think that was all, as you look back on that, sort of related to your life, your search, your journey?
You know, because you come out of the experience of having a child out of wedlock, and again, even in 1978, that stigma was still pretty heavy, and you automatically think of yourself as less than. You know, I must be somewhat trashy if I did this, you know. So as a result, you tend to seek out less than partners or less than relationships, or women have turned to drugs or alcohol, you know, to dull that. So it doesn't leave you in a very good place.
Yeah.
And some women have met with suicide themselves as a result.
Do you think, sort of broadly speaking, that babies like you that were adopted, that either the convents or the church or the government in Ireland just never thought you'd come back, that you would never do the things that you and other women have done, which is to track down these moms?
I'm absolutely certain of that. I just, you know, I don't think 50 years ago they ever thought of anything like the internet or, you know, thought there was
Nobody
a possibility.
Did, yeah.
And there was, ironically, a trickle of people who were going back in the late 70s and 80s. I mean, even before the internet, I do know folks that said, oh, well, I'm going on a trip to Ireland, so I'm going to go back to Shawnross Abbey or Bessborough. And just see if I can get information on myself. And I think it more or less shocked some of the nuns. They just never expected that the children would now, you know, return. But given that it was so few at that time, I think they felt somewhat complacent and, you know, gave him little bits and scraps and, you know, if you really want to seriously trace, go home and think about it and come back to us. Well, by that point, the people were going on with their lives or just entering careers, so I just didn't give it a second thought at the time. But now it's been this sort of huge explosion, especially since it's hit the media's attention.
And Bessborough, what have you been there?
I have, yes. I got quite an experience back in 2010. I filmed a documentary for RTE television, and we actually got permission to film inside, which most people don't really get the opportunity. They won't really let you go into certain quarters. So we sort of got the whole, you know, cook's tour of the place. And it was very moving, very powerful for me. It did bring back a lot of memories that you think you've forgotten. But
really?
Even as a
things
toddler.
That look familiar?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. Triggered so many things for me, you know, smells and sights and sounds. And
did it look austere? Did it look uninviting? Did it look cold?
No. It was actually a former manor house that had been willed to the church. So it was a very lovely estate. I mean, beautiful grounds. It's in a beautiful setting in Cork. And I remember even commenting as I was standing up in the mother's residence looking out the window over the River Lee, you know, my God, this would make a beautiful hotel. Yeah, I mean,
like a B&B of some sort.
Exactly. So, you know, not austere in the sense of the architecture, but certainly inside, you know, you could almost sense the ghosts and just this heavy feeling of oppression inside the place.
I do want to get to our callers, but I was also reading one of the things that you discovered is that as a little girl or a baby, there was some experiment that was done on you for what sounded like vaccines or some kind of drug experiment.
Right. Back between 1960 and 61, actually at several of the homes, not just at Bessborough, but some of the other Sacred Heart homes in Ireland, Burroughs Wellcome, which is what it was known as at the time, it's now GlaxoSmithKline, were doing combination vaccine trials. I guess it was the first time that they had thought about the idea, well, maybe we could administer the typical diphtheria, whooping cough, polio, et cetera, in one injection. And I was part of one of the groups that was given this active test vaccine, which, you know, on the surface would not seem so evil or hideous or wrong, except that we were still legally our mother's children. They hadn't relinquished us, and our mothers were not asked permission for us to be involved in those trials. So the ethics were a little sketchy at best.
You know. Did your mother know?
No. She said she remembered we actually testified before an investigatory committee back in the early 2000s. And she said, no, you know, she was told, well, Mary has to get her jabs before she can be adopted. And that was it. And they took me off and gave me my shots. And she had no clue, you know, what was being done.
Let me get to our callers at 1-888-477-9499, covering a lot of territory in this hour of Radio Times. Mary Steed, our guest, and we've been talking about her mother, who worked at one of the notorious Magdalen laundries in Ireland. Steed is co-founder of Justice for Magdalens, and the Irish government acknowledged last year the mistreatment of these young women and girls, and we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get to, it looks like Ronnie from Fairmount to join us on Radio Times. Ronnie, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning. Mary, hi. I just wanted to say that Mary's comes across so humble. I actually know her, and she is one of the most dogged, committed, and really, truly brave people. And she, I don't want to say single-handedly, because that's not a word that she would feel comfortable using, but she began to look at this and just spent years and years and never backed down. There was a million doors slammed in her face, and she just kept going. And I'm just in, I'm really in awe of her, and just so glad that you have her on your wonderful show, so that other people can hear her. I think she's an absolute heroine for the ages, and she has been a voice for people who no one would listen to. And just thank you for having her on. And Mary, it's Ronnie, and great to hear your voice.
Well, Ronnie, you're going to have to disclose a little bit more about yourself, because our guest knows who you are, but we don't know who you are. Go ahead.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay.
My name is Ronnie Polineski.
Ronnie.
I'm a freelance a little bit, and I went to high school with Mary, have just been such a so impressed and moved by her story. And you know, there's a Boston College professor, James Smith, who wrote a history of the Magdalens, and he talks about Mary as if he just cannot believe the gem that he found. And he has often made the point that, you know, years ago, Ireland thought that they could, you know, export its problem children, that's quoting him directly, and they could never be held accountable for it. But no one ever expected those babies to grow up, find the internet, do the research, return to fight for themselves and their parents. I mean, it's just extraordinary. And so Mary and the people from Justice for Magdalens have really corrected the narrative of Irish history, which needed to be done. I mean, you have these women who were buried in graves, and no one knew their names, and Ireland thought that they could just have a memorial bench for these people, and that would be good enough. And Mary and her partners in crime there just would not give up, and it's just an unbelievable story. So
it is.
Just so proud to know her, and just really, really glad to hear her today. So thank you very much.
Well, Ronnie, I have
to thank
you, because it was reading the article that you wrote in Philadelphia Magazine that got us thinking.
Thank you.
It got us thinking about Mary Steed. So it's all, you know, it's all sort of fits together very nicely. And I appreciate
Mary has a book in her, and Mary, I hope you get it out.
I will eventually. Thanks.
She has a funny grin on her face,
yeah.
Ronnie, while you're talking, and her eyes looking down like she doesn't quite want to take it all in.
No.
Thanks a lot, Ronnie, for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. And I'm wondering, just this organization that you're part of, Justice for Magdalens, the kind of support that your fellow, you know, partners in crime, as Ronnie said, have for each other.
Well, we were such a small band of all volunteers. None of us ever drew a salary from this. It was all, between our work and our families and everything else, you know, rushing to do Skype calls in the middle of the night and so forth. And there were days when we'd say, geez, where are those clones that we ordered? You know, they're just not coming. We need them. But just such dedication and such ethics. And I think that was what really truly amazed me about the group, was we never lost sight of the women, of what we were there for. It can get very easy to be sucked in by media, by this, by that. And we just chose to ride above it and stay above it. And I think we've, you know, done a good job of that.
And dogged. I mean, that would be a word.
Absolutely.
We
not giving up. Right.
And that's Mary Steed, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. Again, co-founded Justice for Magdalens back in 2003. I'm Marty Moscowain, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get to, it looks like Peter from Drexel Hill to join us. And Peter, go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I'm 68. I was adopted as a two-week-old little baby. And I met my biological parents when I was 35, because they opened up the adoption records in Pennsylvania. I met my biological mother and my biological father, but they were separated. They weren't married at all. But anyway, my main point is that I feel that adopted folks have a greater need to know their biological parents, and then the need of the privacy of the biological mother and father. Mm-hmm. That's the way I feel. I just wanted to, you know, bring that fact to light with your guest and you, Marty.
Well, Peter, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'd be curious, Mary, as we said, this is complicated.
Peter, you brought up an excellent point, and that was that you were able to get your records in Pennsylvania, and that would have been prior to 1984. Records were open in the state of Pennsylvania. They sealed them in 1984. And one of the leading proponents of that sealed records initiative was the Catholic Coalition in Pennsylvania. So I think that's fairly telling in that there was much to hide and perhaps a reason to seal those records. I don't think it was ever designed to protect birth parent privacy or adoptee privacy. But, you know, here we are, and there are 44 U.S. states that have sealed records. Only six are open.
Peter, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You mentioned early in the hour about, I don't know whether you lost your faith, but you're no longer a practicing Catholic. Is it in part because of this story we've been talking about?
Yeah, I mean, that has a lot to do with it. I just, you know, I saw so much of the hypocrisy and the unnecessary shame and marginalizing of people simply because of religious mores, and I just couldn't get it. I think from the time I was 13, I never quite got it. But the older I got and the more I learned about my own history, I would not say I'm not a spiritual person, but I just organized religion is not something I feel comfortable within.
And Justice for Magdalene's will continue?
Well, JFM is actually, you know, we've sort of not sidelined. I mean, our campaigning is over since we have gotten the apology and redresses in process. We are going to continue with, historic. An oral history project, I should say, historically writing down and preserving these women's stories. And then, of course, now the next project is on the adoption front, so reuniting, you know, or hopefully reuniting mothers and their children, and working with the PhilomenaProject.org, which is the wonderful new foundation we've got with Philomena's support.
Well, Mary Steed, it's been a great pleasure. I thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times and telling us this very important story.
Thank you, Marty.
You're very welcome. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times to find out much more about this program. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty McMahon, Debbie Builder, and Emily Bryant. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us on Radio Times today.